John Briggs Consultancy, leading Australia's reconciliation and Indigenous engagement journey. As a leading specialist in his field of training, consulting and facilitation, John has an exceptional talent for bringing each participant, organisation and audience along on a journey of discovery. He is a master of building cultural safety with any group. John works with audiences of all levels and backgrounds, from senior executives to students and educators. He covers political, legislative, and economic pillars to help participants gain a better understanding of Indigenous governance in a holistic framework. John Briggs Consultancy is the exclusive provider and subject matter expert around Indigenous engagement for Coles nationally, and he's delivered more than 180 presentations for them since 2011. If you want to find out more about John Briggs Consultancy, please go to www.johnbriggs.net.au or call John direct on 0417 003 565. From Claire Field and Associates, I'm Claire, and I'm pleased that you could join me for this episode of What Now, What Next? Insights into Australia's tertiary education sector. 29 episodes so far, and this week it's a beauty. I'm joined for the first time by three repeat guests who have previously joined me on the podcast to discuss higher education funding and reform. And with everything that's happening in the sector at the moment, I just had to invite them back, and they were good enough to say yes. So on today's episode, I'm joined by Professor Andrew Norton, who is the Professor in the Practice of Higher Education Policy at the Centre for Social Research at the Australian National University. Andrew joined me on the podcast last year after he had finished up leading the Grattan Institute's Higher Education Research Program to share his insights on higher education funding reform. If you haven't listened to that episode yet and want to know more about Andrew and his different roles in the sector, then you might want to listen back to episode 7. Also joining Andrew and I today are Luke Shee, the Executive Director of the Australian Technology Network of Universities, the ATN, and Connor King, the Executive Director of the Innovative Research Universities, the IRU. Luke and Connor were on the podcast late last year, episode 15, so if you want to know more about them or their respective peak bodies and the universities that they represent, then do have a listen in to that episode. And now for today's episode. It was terrific to have three leading voices in the Australian higher education sector join me in discussing Minister Tehan's university reforms. I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed the conversation. It's a pleasure for me. This is the first time that I've ever had guests return to the podcast, and I've got three terrific people in the higher education sector to talk through the reforms of higher education that Minister Tehan is looking to progress. So I'm not going to do long introductions because they've already introduced themselves previously on earlier podcasts, but I'm very pleased to have joining me for this conversation, Andrew Norton, who is now the Professor in the Practice of Higher Education Policy at the Centre for Social Research and Methods at the ANU, Connor King, the Executive Director at the Innovative Research Universities Peak Body, and Luke Shee, the Executive Director at the Australian Technology Network of Universities Peak Body. So, gentlemen, welcome back. Thank you for making time again. When we spoke last year, there were pieces of reform happening. And Luke and Connor, in our conversation, you were the ones who suggested to me this is the reforms that we'd seen last year were part of a bigger reform picture. And certainly we got a much better sense of that. on the 19th of June at the Minister's Press Club address. So before I kick off and ask you a suite of questions about what you think about these reforms and how they might all come together, just for listeners, I wanted to make sure that we're all on the same page. So to my mind, looking at all of the reforms that the Minister has so far announced or enacted, we're looking at changes to student fees for undergraduate study. And by my calculations, they will result in approximately 40% of students paying 93% of the cost of their courses. If Andrew, yourself and Bruce Chapman are right, and I think you are, that students will not be very price sensitive. To my mind, that's a major shift back towards a full fee paying approach, almost but not quite, for university study. We've got the government looking to introduce price signals in the form of lower student fees, which are designed to encourage students into courses with better employment outcomes, although actually that's not necessarily what the data shows. We've got international student numbers, I think, likely to be impacted by not just COVID-19 and closed borders at the moment, but whatever the new prudential requirements are that the government's looking to introduce. We've got a raft of micro-credentials and short courses, changes to the funding rates that universities receive from both students and the government contribution for almost all of the courses. And the one that stood out for me is probably not going to be an expansion into environmental studies. I wouldn't have thought, with funding for that those courses going down by $10,000 a year. And overall growth in the system, but being funded off the same level of government funding, so using growth through efficiencies to drive growth in the system. Funding flexibility in a couple of different ways for how universities might use their Commonwealth funding. University colleges, a fairly strong hint, I think, in the Minister's speech that he's open to down the track. Them receiving Commonwealth funding as teaching-only institutions. We've got performance measures and some funding having been attached to that already. And then what's been described as a merit-based research funding pipeline, which I think sits alongside and, you know, potentially interacts either positively or negatively with the Coaldrake review recommendations around to be a university, you have to have 50% or more of your research at a world-class level across the various fields of education that you offer. And then, most recently, since the Press Club speech, we've now got a new integrity unit being set up in TEXA, which is going to have a quite a different role in its interactions with the universities, including scrutinising where they get there, which, you know, students are enrolled in which courses and whether that's an appropriate level of change within their institutions. So, pausing for breath. To my mind, these are a significant number of changes. And with that, by way of, you know, background and where we are, I'm going to start off, first of all, with you, if you wouldn't mind, Andrew. Is this the right set of changes, looking at the economic circumstances that we're in, where the country is at because of the pandemic and other factors? If you were the minister, are these the reform proposals that you would be putting together? Is this what the country needs?
Look, I think I would go for some efficiency dividend to squeeze some more places out of the system. But I'm not sure that I would accompany it with this, you know, wholesale, as you have described, reorganisation of funding rates. And so, as you've kind of indicated, I don't expect there will be huge shifts in discipline level demand. And if you did want to shift it, it would actually be more effective to directly market to students that certain courses have opportunities they may be missing. And so you could do that at a much, much lower cost than shuffling hundreds of millions of dollars around the system, which is what we're doing right now.
Okay, thank you. Connor, your thoughts? Are these the kinds of reforms that the country needs? And if not, what are the alternatives that you think would work better?
Thanks, Claire. Look, my summary of the package is a little differently structured from yours, and it gets to the question of why this is, in a sense, needed, and that is the expected increase in the main student cohort in coming years, the ever-ongoing increased expectation for people to have tertiary and within that higher education, and whatever COVID-19 adds on top. So to me, this is basically a system to expand the number of students, which is Tien's was his key thing. He knew he had to find a solution to. And the envelope of funding, if you don't want to do demand driven, then you have an envelope and you give the maximum flexibility within that, because you do have the cap. So you have to work within that system. So we can talk about the expansion a bit later. And that's paid for by reworking the clusters. Now, you can get excited, as everyone has been, about this is here, that's there, up and down. But the essence of it is that the government saves on any given profile, it'll save money from that, and it uses that to pay for that expansion. It also uses it to, well, it's revamping the series of equity and regional funds into one big one, but yet not actually changing much for a little while, but it will drive HEP slightly differently to be what HEP always was meant to be, I would argue. And the fund that you talked about, the lovingly acronym NPILF, who knows what that's about, but no doubt we'll get stuck into the detail of that. And then the suite of NAPTHINE-driven regional reforms or changes and incentives to target Dan Tien's particular interest, which is the imbalance of access from people in regional remote areas. And those things are all funded, again, from that change to the clusters. So the cluster changes is about generating money to pay for the rest of it. Now, allegedly, this all adds up to zero. We don't know that because there is no fiscal statement out there. And with the CPI increase, it must be fiscally neutral over a few years, but not in the longer term. So that's actually significant to give universities a mechanism to steadily increase the amount of money they have and the number of students. Then there are a lot of problems within that, but that's the basic package. And I think it does what we need in that sense within the coalition's somewhat limited framework.
Okay, very good. Luke, your thoughts, similar, different? Would you be changing things?
I think taking Connor's last point is the way I characterise these reforms, which is, I think, a classic, Liberal Minister for Education has been tasked with increasing participation, sending some labour market signals, and leading towards addressing some of the longer term issues in higher education, particularly the 2024 increase in school leavers with the so-called Costello baby boom, which we've talked about before. But it is all done within the kind of cost-neutral prism. So Andrew and Connor have articulated that quite well, I think it is a wholesale move from grants-based funding, which was supposed to do a range of things across higher education, to a closer to activity-based funding for teaching and learning. I don't think the whole reform is I think, to be honest, we're going to see more reforms. There's going to be discussion around how university research is funded. There's certainly nothing in the package that addresses short courses, lifelong learning and micro-credentials on the surface of it. And that's something particularly my universities are interested in as a kind of signal in the longer term reform of tertiary education, how we might address workers, particularly now during the global pandemic, who are experiencing quite severe disruption, either losing jobs or being on JobKeeper with their companies being in hibernation, and addressing that issue about how do we take workers in the current labour market and give them the skills or reskilling or upskilling options. So there's a couple of things that I think are yet to come in this package. It's a very complicated package. And to Connor's point, what it does now is instead of having funding that literally follows each student comes in as a subsidised Australian student, it now is ostensibly a block grant with a whole range of formulas applied to it. And it is quite complicated, particularly now because we are grandfathering students that are currently in the system under the old arrangements for a number of years, We're putting the new students in with the lower rates of both direct grant and changes to student fees, either up or down. And so it's quite a beast to look at. So we've spent, I think there's a little bit of Twitter chat about this the last couple of days, but I think many of us in the sector have spent the last 7 or 8 or 9 days looking at how this all impacts our individual institutions. So yes, it's quite a complex package, but it is certainly something done within that prism of no additional expenditure in the first couple of years. So of course it would keep the central agencies, Treasury and Finance happy. But in the long run, it is somewhat disappointing that I think that there's not a particular increase in overall funding in the first instance, given that we know in tertiary education, in times of economic recession, it's countercyclical. So we expect enrollment demand to go up, and I would have anticipated a little bit more new money, so to speak. And I don't like that expression, new money, because I think it's a bit confusing, but overall an increased contribution from the Commonwealth, even if it was small. But complicated and very well thought through package. And, of course, because of the complex nature, we're still looking at all those details.
I agree. I had thought that some additional funding would be important given the recession that the country is in. And it's not clear, you know, quite when economic good times are going to befall us. Before I move on to the next question, Andrew, I wanted to go back to you, if you don't mind, just thinking about the Costello baby boom, which is, you know, quite a visual image. But it is something that yourself and David Phillips, amongst others, sat on a panel at the Universities Australia conference not so long ago, feels like a lifetime, and it was something in particular that you were talking about the issues in terms of how those extra places were going to be funded. From what you've seen in this package, is there enough in it for all of those baby boom children?
I can't see that there is. So, like Luke, I think there probably will have to be some so-called new money later on. But effectively, the savings from the grandfathering of students will be exhausted very, very quickly. And so it's not clear that we can add what I would predict to be at least 20,000 a year new school leaver commences. And, of course, that will have a pipeline effect because first years turn to second years. So I can't see that on a budget-neutral basis they can be accommodated. All we're really doing at this point is probably creating some extra new places for an previously unexpected spike in demand due to the COVID-19 recession. And so I think that problem, even though the government is laying one of the foundations, which is lower per student costs, it's still going to need additional Commonwealth grant scheme money for this to happen in the mid-2020s.
I want to turn now to something that I've found possibly more interesting than others. And I'm thinking about the greater flexibility that this package provides to institutions. And as I understand it, it provides it in two ways. Firstly, the ability to use the funding up and down the AQF ladder, so to speak, so that institutions who want to expand the number of students who might enrol in a sub-bachelor course prior to them moving on to their, you know, bachelor's degree are able to do so, and potentially, if there is any need, also at the postgraduate level. So that's one form of flexibility. And then the other is this notion, and we've emailed a little bit around it, about being able to trade places. And while I, you know, appreciate that there was a brief attempt at this around, I think, a limited number of places, 1,500 of them or so last year, I'd be interested in your thoughts about, and maybe no one will ever do this, and that would be interesting, at least for me to understand. I see this potential flexibility around trading places from one institution to another in the context of Coldrake's recommendation that, you know, by 2030, all universities need to be at that 50% of research excellence across their fields of education. And there's currently a number of public universities, leave aside the private ones, that's a, you know, whole nother podcast, but there's a number of public universities that either aren't at that benchmark or are only just recently got there. And if we're looking at a decade of less funding, I can't see that, you know, prudential requirements around international students is going to see the minister encourage more from our two key markets of China and India. And we're not yet sure how this research pipeline will work, but it has been described by Universities Australia as merit-based. Doesn't that potentially open up the opportunity or need for universities to rethink some of their offerings across different fields of education? Is that where the trading places idea might make some sense? Or if you found yourself, you know, struggling a bit in terms of that level of excellence, do you close down your fields of education? So that's quite a lot of, I appreciate Claire's rambling question, but these are the issues that I'm grappling with in my mind around this funding flexibility. Connor, I'm going to start with you on this one. I think we have slightly different thoughts on this. Can you help me understand what I'm missing or what doesn't quite make sense?
Well, there are quite a few things you just raised in there. And I'm thinking myself through what the envelope options provide to universities. Perhaps I could go back in history a little bit. The initial Gillard-Bradley statement allowed for complete freedom to grow in the sub-bachelor as well as the bachelor, and there was a degree of growth there which actually worried the TAFEs. Luke, actually in a position in his former role to comment on why that was stopped. Partly it helped save money. So we have had that kind of flexibility before, not with the postgrad level, but then at the same time, Julie Gillard gave out postgraduate places with a degree of freedom I don't think any other minister before or since has done. So there was a lot of rebalancing going on. If you have a cap on the total envelope, then setting internal boundaries only makes the problem worse. So this does allow universities full flexibility, and the minister and government will push strongly at, you know, use it, find the students and use the money up. I'm interested to some degree how the generalists followed by vocational degree structures at Melbourne and UWA might take advantage of this. There are some different interesting issues there. And the postgraduate interacts with fee-paying. Fee-paying students give you more money, they give you more control, but there are only so many people prepared to pay. So how that will play out will be interesting. And it possibly encourages the various professions to insist that you must have a master's of whatever it happens to be if you are to go out there and do anything in a practical, applied way and earn money from it. So the opportunities there will be quite interesting, and there will be some mix and things happening. So I agree with you, Claire, that it does offer up some options, but it's not necessarily unheard of in the past, but it's the only way you can make that happen if you want to keep overall control on things. Some of your other points there, or maybe I should let Andrew or Luke have a go on this issue. In terms of diversity, and clearly universities will look at the funding received, and despite the minister flourishing the Deloitte's report around the extent to which money goes down in some of those discipline areas, the internal decisions to use money to support the need to educate rather than follow the money, which is always an ongoing internal challenge from the universities, will put pressure on some of those science and health areas. So there may well be people looking for roles, but universities may or may not want to offer them, and that could lead to some change. I'm not a big fan on diversity. I actually think universities are fairly diverse. If I stick my current city, I would say RMIT and Melbourne, neither of them belong to my group, sitting right next to each other, are pretty different in what they offer, but they are both full-fledged universities. So there's a fair bit of change there. I also think it's quite reasonable that if you wander down to your local university, whoever you choose to define it, you can get access to most courses. That strikes me as the kind of thing you'd expect to happen. No one has ever yet, I heard, called for more diversified, specialised primary schools in this country. You expect them to deliver for everyone in their area. So I'm a little bit of a sceptic on some of those themes. But I certainly agree with you, the opportunity there for other providers, whatever the National Institute's ones are now, the university college types to come into the system. That, again, also was proposed in Bradley, if you go back to the report, never endorsed by that government. So that option has sat there for a long time. Whether it comes off now, I don't really know. The possibility is there, and certainly the funding has been switched around to make it much more explicitly for teaching and hence make it easier to rationalise extending that to other institutions. That, of course, will cost the government money, which is possibly the main reason it's held back to date. You have to give it to institutions already teaching students. So initially you buy education for people who are already paying it. So there's a bit of a hurdle for a cost-cutting government to get over on that point. But at some point over the next decade, I expect them to do it.
Thank you. That's a very helpful articulation of where you see this flexibility sitting. And I have to say, I agree with you. I think in metropolitan areas, it might be a bit different. And yes, there is some specialisation across our institutions. But the further that you go out of capital cities, I think the more need that there is for comprehensive universities to be available to learners. Andrew, I'm going to go to you on Connor's last point. This is something that we discussed many years ago when I was at ACPED, and you'd and David Kemp, you'd put your report to Minister Pine, and we're thinking about whether it was you'd suggested that non-university higher education providers could have access to Commonwealth funding, but it ought to be on the the same arrangements, not a, full fee-paying or fee-for-service kind of approach. And we discussed at the time that that's not necessarily going to be attractive to some institutions who can, as the some parts of the universities can with their postgrad, actually generate more income with the full fee-paying flexibility. Did you want to comment on that and also where and how you see this option for funding flexibility impacting across the universities?
Yes, so I still think that the non-uni providers should be eligible for Commonwealth-supported places, but as I always stressed at those ACPEC meetings, be careful what you wish for, because there's a lot of downsides involved in being in the Commonwealth funding system, as we're kind of seeing with this tumultuous package right now. And so good reasons to insulate yourself from it if you're a private provider, and also to maintain the level of fee income to provide what is actually quite a distinctive form of education. Like these Commonwealth funding rates, even more now than under the TEIN package than under the current system, are really designed around economies of scale. And so if you cannot achieve scale, these funding rates probably aren't right for you. I think on the moving of funding around the system and up and down the AQF, look, I'm not opposed to moving between institutions, because one of the flaws or the weaknesses of a block grant system, say compared to the demand-driven system, is that it's relatively hard to move funding where the students really need it. And so to the extent that there are universities that cannot fill all their places, as been the case in recent years, it is a small efficiency to be able to trade them, maybe temporarily, to an institution that can actually use them. I think, as Connor was alluding to, the problem here with the AQF movements is really the movement up into postgraduate. And so particularly when we've got a fixed pot of money for all coursework Commonwealth-supported places, postgraduates are essentially double-dipping in a limited pool. And at the margins, when we're moving into a high growth phase for school leavers, that will mean less money left over for people seeking their first qualification. So I think that is actually quite a problematic change. Multiple reviews, including those I've served on, have struggled about how to best deal with postgraduate Commonwealth supported places. But given there is that flexibility in the fee-paying side, I'm very, very cautious about allowing universities to expand their postgraduate Commonwealth-supported enrolments. Claire?
And Luke, now, Connor mentioned discussions he'd had when you were in a different role, worried about the expansion of sub-bachelor places and what this would mean for the TAFE sector. Again, it's something that Andrew and I discussed years ago when when I was at ACPED, and it looked like it was on the cards, and I was concerned about the whole vet sector, TAFE and those private providers. Did you want to share your views on the funding flexibility, sub-bachelor, post-grad, and this notion potentially of some flexibility to trade places?
Yeah, thanks, Claire. I mean, yes, I mean, O'Connor was right. The original recommendation out of the Bradley Review was to uncap both undergraduate and sub-bachelor places. And given that AQF, the competition with diplomas and advanced diplomas at TAFE, there was a bit of concern in the sector. There certainly was concern from the Minister for Finance at the time that it was going to cost a lot of money. So I think it was a fiscal decision that also was enhanced by a sector concerned in the first instance. I've always thought uncapping sub-bachelor was a good idea, and I've certainly, welcomed it when it was proposed by Birmingham and Pine, I think, in previous packages. But I think that era is gone, because we certainly are, in terms of this package, we read the tea leaves, the government is not in the mood for particular increase in the overall cost of universities. So I think we need to put that to one side. I think there are a couple of things in the allocated system, so sub-bachelor, postgraduate and enabling courses, which I think need to be addressed over the long term. Firstly, the allocation of postgraduate places is based on historical, allocations from various ministers to universities directly, and I describe that in the past as slightly irrational. It doesn't kind of link with labour market need particularly. Of course, in the situation where you've got a more graduate school model like the University of Melbourne and Western West Australia, that's fine to quarantine those places. But I think there is reform that should be made to the allocation of postgraduate places. And to Andrew's point, students could pay full fees for those courses, and they've already had the vast majority of them have probably already had a subsidised foundational qualification at an undergraduate level. So that we have to talk about a bit of equity and fairness there. With sub-bachelor and the movement around, I'm not quite sure what you're trading. So I know the Minister mentioned there was an instance where Swinburne University, which had an increased demand for sub-bachelor places, spoke to the University of Tasmania, who had many allocated to them throughout many election cycles, and they couldn't quite use them all. I'm not quite sure what they traded. I know that there was, I think, a year where they took some of those places and used them at Swinburne, but I think that's kind of, we have to work out what the mechanisms are in order to move that load around the system. What I would like is something that assists the labour market and assists, businesses and other parts of the country get the skilled workers they need. So we need some sort of signals around that. It's been intimated in the past in previous discussions on sub-bachelor load that there would be some labour market signals. In terms of the AQF, I think it's a secondary factor that you might move load around in order to change your overall mix. And I don't think universities, given their cash position at the moment with the decline and expected bigger decline in international revenue, are really thinking about the AQF and provider category reforms and how that might, how that might impact their operations over the long time. Because I think they're worried about how they shore up their operations and their staff and their students in the next year or so as a primary concern. But I think if we kind of elevate ourselves past that, I think we want to have a system where we can subsidise places should go that where they're the most effective to both the individual and the country and get the best outcome from that. So we need to come back to some of those principles around when we design systems for reallocation. So I'm interested in trading, but I'm not, again, I'd come to the point, what are we actually trading? Or are you just giving, you borrowing load for a while? So there's some of the concerns that we've had. And, of course, ATN universities have always been quite strong on wanting to have some reform in Commonwealth-supported places for postgraduate. There is some talk that if you have locked in a number of Commonwealth-supported places versus full fee cohorts in similar disciplines, you lack innovation in the way that you design those courses. That's a debate probably for another podcast.
Sounds like we've got a few more, yet to go. Now, I was going to ask you to contextualise these reforms in the, you know, in the reforms that we've had over the last 30 plus years. But in actual fact, I think in the way that you've answered various questions, you've kind of tended to do that. So instead, I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, thinking about when the Senate considers this legislation, if it doesn't pass, where to next? Can I put you a bit on the spot and ask you that? Who wants to jump? Given I haven't preempted this question with you, and I do normally do that with my guests, give them a bit of time to think about things. Purely hypothetical, we haven't seen, you know, any legislation yet. It hasn't had all those debates in Parliament. We don't know where the Senate crossbenchers are going to go. But if we were to do the hypothetical and this doesn't pass, and we've seen, you know, other attempts at reform through this government that haven't, then where do you think the sector should go next? Who wants to leap in and have a go at that one?
I'll have a go.
Okay.
So I actually think if this is blocked, the sector itself is probably better off. You know, it'll avoid a whole lot of complex changes that will cause a lot of internal grief at a time when they're already having to retrench large numbers of people. But the problem is that means that a whole lot of people who are trying to sit out this recession at university won't be able to do so, and will still be stuck with the Costello baby boom cohorts, where the system could well be shrinking rather than growing at just the time they need to go to university. So it will leave a big practical policy problem and a big political problem for the government if this doesn't pass. They'd have to think about why it hasn't passed and whether, you know, a simpler package with some of the pain ease, with just a few $100 million additional funding, might better solve both the policy and political problems.
Connor or Luke, do you want to be hypothetical?
I think if this doesn't pass, the government still has all of these issues to deal with. You know, counter-cyclical increased demand in the sector, the Costello baby boom, and perhaps a more ideological fixation with containing the costs of higher education, both in terms of efficiencies, but also, you know, just kind of generally a grumpiness across parts of the Liberal National Party room towards universities. So I think we might see whatever, in the short term, will be whatever the minister can do via regulation, and we saw how brutal that was on late December 2017 when the funding caps were put in place almost before, you know, way too late for the 2018 academic year, but it did happen nonetheless. I think it will absolutely reach a point of exhaustion with this current government, who've tried a number of times to come up with reform options. That said, I think it will pass the Senate. So I know we're talking about it potentially not passing the Senate. And I think this is back to my earlier point, because I think Tehan and his office and the department have put some serious consideration into addressing a whole range of issues, indexation of funding, you know, looking at the cost of teaching and activity-based funding, how to increase demand without it increasing the overall fiscal impact. So it's a easier sell because it's a well thought through political package in that sense. Yes, to Andrew's point, absolutely complicated, and we now have a block grant system that has a whole range of considerations and variances in the way it operates. And I didn't touch on this before, but of course, some of my universities are disadvantaged because we're the city slickers, so to speak, so our growth rates are contained somewhat for some of our campuses. But I think it will pass, and there may or may not be some trading around elements of the package. But that's where I sit. I'm really not contemplating too much of it not passing.
Connor, last word to you.
Well, I'm probably agreeing with Luke on the probability of a passage, but that would involve some modification, I suspect, to achieve that outcome. It is quite possible, I've done one and I'm going to be asked to do several others, to rework those cluster changes to preserve the government's fiscal desire to save the dollars that it does save but yet reduce some of the extremes that people are particularly excited about, which are the kind of things some of the senators are probably going to be interested in. So, and there are other aspects to the package which also could well be simplified or improved without changing its fiscal architecture, if I could be so terminologically weird, and otherwise, you know, kind of things that the minister could say that's all broadly what he wanted. It would probably moderate some of the extreme vocationalism that the rhetoric says, but I don't think it had much impact. One of the reasons I probably disagree with Andrew is the current system that we have, which would therefore be rolling on if this is knocked off, is the current maximum grants indexed by a population figure. Now, right now, that population figure probably isn't too far off inflation because inflation's pretty low. But if there's some sort of return to normality, that's going to keep constricting the number of students effectively funded by the money. I don't see that as a great outcome, and it's causing to me or achieving for the government quite a deal of savings. So, in fact, I suspect the Department of Finance would be happy in one aspect with that outcome, but we wouldn't be meeting the expected demand. So that's the problem with it. So universities, well, we sit in the middle a bit. I mean, with Pine, we're formally behind it because despite all the ups and downs and around it and the anguish about the fees, it actually offered universities the potential for more money per student indeed. We were clearly against Birmingham because it was all about less money. There was no upside to Birmingham. This one kind of sits in the middle there of you can grow your revenue. Probably the money per student will drift downwards. Can you be more efficient? You know, can you make it work? In that sense, I think the unis are mostly interested in finding a way to improve it, get rid of what we chose to call the kind of unexpected consequences that might lurk in this, and then make it happen. But of course, that will be up to the Senate. So we will indeed have 4 or 5 months, the October, November, I assume, before we know the answer.
Thank you, all three of you, very much. Such an interesting conversation. And I think for listeners who are trying to grapple with it, it's certainly given them as much food for thought as it's given me. Just before I say goodbye and let you get back to your busy days, implicit and explicit in a number of the observations and comments that you've shared has been the impact on staff. And I recently had Belinda Robinson from UC on the podcast, and she spoke in quite a lot of detail about that. And I think really important to keep in mind, we have a lot of conversation about the impact on students, and we're thinking about the impact on institutions as a whole. This would be enormously stressful for staff who are coping with all sorts of other stresses and strains in the moment because of the impact of the pandemic. So I probably just wanted to shout out to any of the university staff who are listeners to this podcast that there's sort of recognition in the comments and observations that you've made, and which I particularly wanted to echo around how stressful all of these changes are, even though they're of incredible interest and importance to policy nerds. So thank you very much for taking the time to join me on the podcast, and I'm going to issue an invitation to have the three of you come back once we see where the Senate gets to, and you can tell me, if you don't mind, and listeners, where you think we're heading over the next few years. So, guys, thanks so much for your time today. That's it for now on higher education funding reforms. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, then please get in touch and or take a moment to rate and review us in your favourite podcast app. And you can, of course, also connect with me on Twitter, LinkedIn, or on Facebook. Thank you for joining me for this episode of What Now, What Next? Insights into Australia's tertiary education sector.